Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The love story between Mark Lukacs and his wife Julia started their freshman year in college. But when Julia suffered a month-long psychotic break at the age of 27, their blossoming plans for life and love and career were shattered. Lukacs' memoir, My Lovely Wife in the Psych Ward, chronicles Julia's first psychotic episode, as well as the two that followed over the next 5 years. And he joins us to discuss the book, the power dynamics between patients and their caregivers, and how Julia's illness has changed their marriage. I hope we can get to all that and more in the time we have here. And I must say, this is an inspiring and a remarkable story, and it's a story that kept my attention. And welcome, Mark.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Really glad to have you. It's a story also. I was just joking with Mark before we went on the air about how you don't find that many stories from his generation, not to sully your generation, about love and commitment. But this really is a story about love and commitment, and a very inspiring one. Let's start off with the life you had. I mean, before your wife had her psychotic breakdown, the first one and so forth, and wound up in the psych ward. You were a couple really who... I had a charmed life, pretty much.
I mean, absolutely.
A lot of surfing and a lot of capture the flag and music and friendship. And
sitting on the beach, watching sunset, that kind of cheesy stuff. Exactly.
Yeah. But, loving and most of all, loving.
Very much so. And I think our vision of love was very romantic. And it was also, we met so young and I think fell in love so effortlessly, like it felt inevitable, that we thought love was fun and exciting. And I still believe it is fun and exciting, right? But I don't think we had the full picture of what loving someone for the rest of your life actually means until we had to face this trial together.
You didn't have the picture of how life can blindside you in ways that you could never anticipate or expect. But you made a decision. I want to talk about actually what you went through, but then I want to talk about the decision, because it was while you were surfing, and it's a real epiphany that kept you not only committed in the relationship, but decidedly so. When did you start to have – I've read the book, and it seems like you started to have at least some concerns when your wife was – had a job, and it was kind of what she described as a cool job, and she liked her boss and everything about it, but was so anxiety-ridden about what she was writing.
Yeah, exactly. She basically, she's always been incredibly accomplished. I mean, in college, she had a near-perfect GPA and had amazing internships throughout the summer, and I always heard rave reviews from all of her teachers and bosses. And so when she started this new job while we were living here in San Francisco, there was this hesitation and insecurity that I had never seen before in her. And that rapidly grew into basically what I would describe as work paralysis. She'd spend hours just trying to write a really basic email. She'd forward it to me for proofreading, and it was like two sentences long. And that was when I could tell, like, something's off here. I didn't know what. And I had really, like, no understanding of the mental health world. We had a pretty, what I would say now, flawed view of it. We thought that if you take medication, that's a sign of weakness. We believed in the concept of therapy, so we pursued that. But honestly, I just think having this very privileged, charmed experience as a couple, we thought, oh, this is just going to go away. Like, Julia's just going to be fine.
She's, you thought you were invulnerable, essentially.
Exactly, yeah.
And then you're 27, 3 years of marriage. Your wife is having problems eating and sleeping, and... suddenly she's besieged by the devil and talking to God and all these kinds of things that you do associate with psychosis.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the lack of sleep was what led to the real problems. And I would try to calm her down and help her relax. But inevitably, I would fall asleep and wake up, and she was often still wide awake. And in that wide awake, she was having delusions, like you said, often of a really religious nature. And it was at that moment that I basically panicked, and I was like, I think I just need to take her to the hospital. I feel like I'm out of my league here. I don't know what to do anymore. So I had to drive her to the ER, and it was there that I first even heard the word psychosis. And they said she needs to be hospitalized. She's probably not safe to be out right now. So they put her on a 5150 and said, you can visit from 7 to 8:30. Otherwise, we're going to take care of her now.
And she went on the antidepressants and the antipsychotic medication, mm-hmm. and suddenly you had a whole different world, and you had all the complications of medication and many of the side effects and so forth. And you were in a total caregiving situation.
Well, I think that was the challenge, is that I wasn't calling the shots at all, because I know, like I said, I didn't know almost anything about mental illness. But I was the one at home sitting with Julia and needing to make sure she took her medication. So I needed to act like I was in control. And I needed to convince myself that what we were doing was for her benefit. So Julia would often complain about the side effects of these medications and how they made her thinking sluggish. And I would just rationalize those away and say, you know, this is what we need to do, because otherwise you're going to have another psychotic episode. And
it was the Zyprexa, which put on 40 pounds as a side effect.
Yeah,
acne.
Exactly. Yeah. And she, you know, she didn't like it. And I unfortunately had a hard time hearing that, because I was so scared that I thought that the worst possible outcome was another psychotic episode. And so anything was better than that, even if it meant these pills that made her feel terrible. It was okay, because that was going to be temporary, and at least it would keep the psychosis away.
We're talking, if you just joined us, with Mark Lukacs. He's the author of a book called My Lovely Wife in the Psych Ward. And the psych, we were terrified about the psych ward, too. I mean, there were some scary people there. Your wife at one point was kissed while she was in the so-called psych ward. And you got very enraged about that and had a lot of, I mean, you write about a lot of the nuances of dealing with people who were sometimes difficult to deal with. I mean, right. There were kind people and certainly good professional people, but there were also people that got your dander up.
Yeah, it was just a different world to step into. And I understand that they need to focus all their attention on their patients. But I did feel in many situations that as a family member who wanted to be there and wanted to help, that I was kind of left at arm's length a little bit, which made me feel so powerless. And that sense of fear was just like tenfold, because I had all these questions and I didn't know who to ask, and I wasn't necessarily getting answers from them. So the system itself could be frustrating. As for the patients, I just had never seen what mental illness in its extreme form can look like. And so I remember that first moment when I was looking through and seeing all these people there, I just couldn't imagine that Julia was now in there with
one of them.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, and in many respects, Julia was not Julia anymore. Julia was someone who was afflicted and who, you know, really needed mental care and so forth and medication and so forth. And I know you've been asked this because I read your book many times by many people. Why did you stay with it?
Right.
You know, it's especially when you're with a different person.
Right.
A lot of young people would just say, I didn't sign up for this. I'm leaving.
Well, I'm not going to lie. There were times when I felt that way for sure.
But you didn't leave.
No, absolutely. I think for starters, when a crisis hits, I felt like I was in survival mode. And I thought that the really only thing that I could do was just try to help and try to make sure Julia was okay. You have to remember, we met when we were 18. So this was after we had been together for 9 years. I felt like Julia was my past and my present. And I honestly couldn't see a future without Julia. I also have to say that I feel lucky that I came from a family who believes in family a lot and talks about loving and caring for each other, kind of no matter the circumstances. And I feel like Julia comes from a similar family. And so this just kind of felt part of my DNA, that like, this was my wife. This was who I had chosen to be with. This wasn't the family I was born into coincidentally, but the person who I actually decided, hey, I'm picking you and you're picking me, and we're actually going to stay together through no matter what.
Well, that gets to that moment again when you were in the water and the dolphins appeared.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
So I was basically at a moment of like existential crisis. And so I went to Ocean Beach here in San Francisco to go for a surf. But I really just needed to be alone and kind of surrounded by beauty. And I was out there thinking about the worst case scenario of maybe never getting the Julia that I had fallen in love with back again. And so I was really just kind of floating in the water, crying a lot, pondering if I could make it through a future that looked like that. And then I felt like the world sort of told me an answer, because these two dolphins came swimming my way and they literally swam right under me. And I mean, it didn't take much to put it together that these two dolphins in the massive ocean going on their path together. I just said, that means I'm with Julia. We're going to do this.
But there was still terror to come and helplessness to come and terrible obstacles.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, she was psychotic for about a month. And then afterwards, she was depressed for about 9 months. And in that depression, she was pretty acutely suicidal. And it's really difficult to hear someone you love talk about wanting to end their own life.
Can you tell that story about the Vespa? Because that's such a powerful story.
Yeah, I came home and Julia was just sitting there fixated on the concept of, It wasn't like if I drive to the Golden Gate Bridge, but when I go to the Golden Gate Bridge. She had decided she would take the Vespa, and we only had this one key. And she's like, I don't know if I'm going to bring the key with me when I jump off or if I'm going to leave the key on the scooter, because she was worried not about her ending her life, but if I would be able to use the Vespa again. And it just showed me the amount of detail she had been spending fixating on what it would look like because of how much pain she was in, you know? And it's so scary and sad to hear that. And, you know, my instinct was just to sort of like bear hug her, you know, like in all ways, like bring her in close and say, hey, we're going to get through this. It's going to be okay. And you mentioned in the introduction, it's about you wanted to talk about the power dynamic. What I had to learn, and I learned it in really a lot of missteps along the way, is how important it was to actually just hear her express her pain and not have to be her problem solver and her fixer. I think a lot of us...
You had to give her agency, really.
Exactly. Yeah. I think a lot of us feel like, oh, someone I love is in a tough spot. I need to go help them. And in fact, what you end up doing is you take away their sense of autonomy and even some of their dignity as well. And so it took me many years and unfortunately many hospitalizations to really fully embrace that. That like, yes, I need to care for Julia and love her, but I need to let her be herself. You know, I want to mention something you said earlier. Julia became like not Julia. And I did go that place the first time, but I've had to actually really work to embrace that this is Julia. Like her hospitalizations, her bipolar disorder, that is her. That is not a separate entity. This is part of the very complex and wonderful woman that I love.
It's not only a bipolar diagnosis. There was a schizophrenic diagnosis.
They flirted with that idea. They actually passed it off and ended up landing on bipolar. But the label is become something you want to try to disassociate. But instead, I've instead worked to just embrace, because I see so much of Julia than just the fact that she's been in the hospital a few times.
Well, during a period when she regained a sense of what, for lack of a better word, we can call normalcy, mm-hmm. I mean, you conceived a child, you went on a tour, went on a worldwide tour, you actually mm-hmm. took off time from your teaching position to mm-hmm. be with her during the caregiving period, but you made what you call a mad map.
Exactly. Right? So basically what we had to do is we had to accept that a relapse was possible, you know, which I think in itself takes a lot of intellectual exercise to get done, because that's sort of like welcoming that the disease might come back, when instead our instinct is to say, hey, we beat this. It's over. We never have to deal with it again. So we first just had to accept that and say, this might happen to us again. Okay, so if it does happen again, let's try to look at the mistakes we both made in the past, the ways that I was overly controlling, and maybe the ways that Julia was too stubborn or not listening to the advice of the professionals. Okay, so if we identified those missteps, how can we create a plan wherein, if Julia is hospitalized and she's having psychotic delusions and the doctor says, I want to give you this medicine, and she says, I don't want it, that medicine, they're trying to kill me, we don't just brush that off as a delusion, but I can speak on her behalf and say, no, Julie and I have talked about this. This specific medicine, it does not work for her. So please do not include that as part of her plan, because only by having what I feel like is this mad map can I actually be her advocate, because then I know what kind of treatment and care she wants as compared to the treatment and care I think she needs.
Our guest is Mark Lukacs, local writer, teacher, and author of My Lovely Wife and the Psych Ward. And we do want to hear from you, our listeners. In fact, if you have a loved one who struggles with mental illness or you've been through that struggle, how do you cope and how does it affect your relationship? And perhaps you have some wisdom that you can shed and some light you can shed in conversation here, and let us know what you've been through. And you may have questions for Mark about his story, which is, as I said, ultimately it's a heartbreaking but inspiring story, and it does have some sense of a happy ending. But we'll, in the meantime, invite your participation in the program. Toll-free number to call, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your involvement, so you can call us now. And again, the number, 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum and click on this segment and put your questions or comments there or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at @KQEDForum. The book, again, My Lovely Wife in the Psych Ward, our guest, Mark Lukacs. You've written and other things besides this book. Were you kind of taking notes during this whole ordeal and travails that you've been through?
I wasn't taking notes, but I was emailing our parents because they were desperate for an update. And I found the process of, after Julia had gone to sleep, sitting down and trying to make sense of what happened during that specific day, I put hours into that. And it helped me actually craft a sense of narrative and a sense of putting myself back in like, okay, I understand what's actually happening here. And I found the process of just writing these emails to be incredibly therapeutic. And it was from there, well after Julia had recovered, that the idea of writing about this publicly was first born, because I think we both recognize that hopefully there was some capacity to help others. I mean, mental illness is still pretty stigmatized. I would say especially the caregiving experience is really under-discussed and underserved. I wasn't finding any books out there about what I was going through. And so I thought, I know there's other people who are sitting there in the waiting room, scared, sad, grieving for a loved one, who would appreciate a sense of community and not feel so alone through it. So that really became the genesis of it. But it's funny, I was just talking out in the hallway. I'm still kind of getting used to the idea that I'm a quote-unquote writer, because I have this one story that I really wanted to tell, and I'm incredibly honored that I had the opportunity to tell it. But I don't really know what else to write about, because this is sort of this fiber of my being, you know?
Well, it's a story that I know has had a good deal of strong reception. I talked about the inspiring nature of the story. It's a story of love and commitment, but it's also a story of survival in many ways and of going through the darkness and finding light.
And I do think that I've been really surprised and touched at how people have been responding to it. And I think it's because, again, like I was referencing earlier, like I think there's so many people who care for loved ones and they don't, whether it's through a mental illness or a different type of diagnosis, a physical ailment, whatever, who go through the frustration and this loneliness and the sadness and the uncertainty, and they feel like no one else gets it. But there's so many caregivers in our midst. And I also think there's so many people who are struggling with a mental illness in our midst. And so you kind of put the two together, and I just think this book has found readers out there who aren't finding a lot of people talking about it.
Well, we're going to find out what our listeners have to say, and I would remind you that we're talking to Mark Lukacs. His book is My Lovely Wife in the Psych Ward, and our first caller is Raina from Santa Rosa. Good morning, Raina.
Good morning. I'm calling to say thank you for writing this book. I was married to someone who has bipolar and who became psychotic, and though I advocated for consistent care for him because of the lack of private insurance, we were subject to rotating physicians, and so we could never get him on consistent medication that didn't have atrocious side effects that made him much worse. And eventually, for my own safety, I ended up having to leave the relationship. But it's really heartening for me to see that you were able to find a way to support your partner, and I want to thank you for writing the book.
Well, thank you for the call. It's good to hear from you, Raina, and I appreciate the call and appreciate also what you have been through. There is now kind of a public role for you in all this. I mean, I was reading something where you said getting that book out there has kind of kept me in line, too.
It has. I first want to respond to Raina, and thanks so much for calling. I'm sorry to hear what you've gone through. I think in the public role of having this story out there, I want to make sure that I'm not saying that you have to stay. Because I recognize that although Julie and I faced a lot of trauma, we also were pretty fortunate. She did find a medication routine that worked with minimal side effects. I've never had her turn violent. She's never tried to run away. She's really never really resisted much. And so despite how difficult it's been, we've also been very fortunate. And so I recognize that there are definitely unique circumstances that make it hard for family members to stay. And I think that is part of checking me in line, that I think what I've had to do is really treat each diagnosis and the associated family members for their, you know, acknowledge the uniqueness of what they're going through and just hope that they can work together to at least advocate for themselves about what they need in the relationship and in the dynamic and make sure that it gets met.
Here's Vince, who writes, after 10 years of marriage with a wife similar to the author's, I had worked myself into confirmed PTSD diagnosis from repeated trauma. A good friend told me she is clearly unfixable. So how are your children served by having two dysfunctional parents? I divorced her. My children and I left our guilt-created reality that was only going to get worse. No medical professional would tell me it was time to let go before I became a codependent victim of mental illness. How do you know when it's time to let go in order to protect yourself?
Yeah, that's, again, thank you for emailing. That's a really gut-wrenching thing to consider, right? Is how do you know? And I think, again, I'm lucky. Julia has these pretty prolonged stretches of stability in between where she gets to resume her career and we get to rebuild the fiber of our relationship with each other, but also with our children.
And each time that she's had a breakdown, I mean, you sort of diminish the number of days, for example, as you move forward.
It has. And so I'm like crossing my fingers here, but it's been 3.5 years since her last hospitalization. And her hospitalizations have been either 3 or 2 years apart. So we're sitting here hopeful that maybe we've broken out of the pattern a little bit, you know? And so when trying to see the I don't know if I want to say the advantages, but the ways we've been lucky through this, it makes it a little easier to acknowledge, to say like, yeah, this is still worth holding on and fighting for. But I think, like I said earlier, I recognize that everyone's going to get to their situation where the best thing for themselves and their family might be to separate.
Here's Lurleen, who writes, this is a more common occurrence than many people think. If we vow to stand beside someone in sickness and in health, surely that includes mental illness. Let me get another caller aboard here, and that's Audrey. Ashley, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, yes. I just want to comment about how useful a partner can be in validating the experiences that one's feeling. I've had social anxiety severely since I was 13. I'm 26 now, so I've been medicated half my life for a condition, and I've had a lot of limitations. But now I'm in a really successful grad program, and a lot of it has been due to my husband and his role in just acknowledging that I have these limitations. And there'll be days I want to make plans, and then I cancel them because I'm too anxious. And instead of getting angry like some of my family members have, he just says it's okay. And he just, the acceptance that it's okay to fail sometimes has made it so incredibly useful for me, just moving on in my life, knowing that this is a lifelong condition, and I have a partner who's willing to support me.
That's amazing. And honestly, that's a good reminder to me, because it's hard to not lose your patience. And I know that I've lost my patience many times. I want to do something either for myself or for my family. And let's say, for example, it's the fall. All of Julia's hospitalizations have happened in the fall. And so the right call is to be more conservative, but I want to push it and I want to go and do something big. I can get frustrated when I have to not, but I just try to take that moment of pause. And so Ashley, thank you so much for the reminder of the role that a supportive partner can play to help you feel like you can thrive in your situation.
And let me thank you, Ashley, for the call. You didn't succumb, though many do in these circumstances, to self-pity. How did you manage that?
Well, I think I definitely did for a while.
Well, that was temporal, though. That was ephemeral, I should say, it seemed.
Yeah, I think.
And when I say succumb, I mean, you know, there are people who are in constant state of self-pity.
No, I agree. And I think it's maybe because despite what we've been through, Julia and I still get to go and dabble in that puppy, dog, rainbows and butterfly, like, romance that we had when we were 18, you know, that we still get to have these moments of amazing magic and love. And so how can I feel bad for myself if I still get to experience that, you know?
I think people are listening to this and thinking Julia is probably with a J, but it's actually with a G. And yeah. She has a father named Romeo, no less.
Yeah. I mean, although pronounced Romeo.
Romero,
Italian.
Yeah. I mean, her background, I mean, when you met her, it was essentially from Italy, and those were her roots. And I assume Roman Catholicism, too. Yeah,
yeah, that's interesting because
of all the God-devil stuff?
That yeah. First hospitalization in particular was so embedded with Catholic imagery, you know, and we were both raised Catholic, And it did have an impact on how we viewed the church.
Also probably had an impact on keeping your marriage together, though, didn't it?
I think so. I mean, for sure. In fact, one of my marriage role models, believe it or not, is a Benedictine monk.
You mentioned him, yeah.
He's obviously not married, but he took a vow when he was even younger than I was, not to get married, but to become an ordained priest and live according to this rule book that was written over 1,500 years ago. And he's in his 80s, and he's still doing it. And I can't even imagine what that's like. And so if this guy can do it, I can definitely at least try.
And here's Rika joining us. Rika, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is about a friend of mine a few years ago who eventually got diagnosed with bipolar disorder. For about a year before that, she started exhibiting really paranoid behavior. She cleared out her bank account and moved to the city, took an apartment. She started writing emails to her parents and accusing her mom of not being her mom. So we all knew something was happening, and her husband, who's really supportive, he sent a medical team to try and get her to, you know, to force her into treatment. But they went and talked to her and said, oh, well, she's not a threat to herself, so we can't do anything about it, because she was extremely coherent. And finally, she moved back with her husband, and in her apartment complex, she was suspecting somebody of leaving threatening packages. And so she was walking around with a knife, and the apartment manager had to call the police. And that's how she eventually had to get treatment. So my question is there nothing that caring spouses and family members and friends can do to hasten this process, which, you know, she could have been in treatment 6 months to a year before this? That's my question. Your guest.
Thank you, Rick. It's a good question, and let's hear it from Mark on this.
You know, every call, every email I get, it's always so heartbreaking because these stories are so difficult. And I think, you know, I'm a history teacher, and so I try to remember the history of how the mentally ill have been treated, which is horrible, right? And so I, too, have run into profound frustration with the way the mental health system did or refused or gave help to Julia, and also the way they engaged with me as her spouse. And every time I felt that frustration, I tried to check myself by saying, if this was a couple hundred years ago, there would have been a completely different outcome. There was no help, you know? They would have just ostracized her as some sort of outcast, right? And so
just throw her in one of those bedlam-type places.
Yeah, and know. So I don't know what the answer to your question is. I'm just trying to share with you what I had to learn, which is it's still a really imperfect system, but it is trying.
Well, your story, as I've said, is very compelling. It's inspiring. And I can say this to you as well as to all those who are caregiving situations. You can act heroically and you can act lovingly, and those two often do not go together, but in your case, they did. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Lukacs, again, is the author of My Lovely Wife in the Psych Ward. This is the Forum Program, and for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.